Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Nicole Lamb.
Hi.
Cole Hornaday.
Hey there.
And, of course, Chris Casso.
Hello.
How is everybody this fine evening?
We're distracted and on our phones.
Yeah.
We're ready to podcast.
We are razor focused.
All right.
Ben Lawrence.
Speaking of being razor focused, Cole Hornaday, you got some North Seattle College news.
I do. In keeping with my plan to totally revamp and take over the North Seattle College Continuing Education Program and fill it with things that I care about, we have, for spring quarter, we have two classes in comic book creation and illustration. You may recall last quarter we had Andrew Steer's very successful comic book illustration. We're actually offering that again, and the class starts on April 19th and goes until June 7th. And in that class, you can learn techniques, illustration techniques, doing storyboarding, position, mood, character design, pacing, all those good things that you need to have the fundamental tool chest for creating comics. The other class that we're offering that I'm particularly excited about for good reason is Tatiana Gill's new class, Draw Your Story, Find Your Voice Through Comics. And this class is devoted to women, people of color, creators who are people of color, members of the LGBT community, and folks that you don't necessarily have a voice in mainstream comics. And Tatiana is offering an opportunity to research research and discover those creators' works and how you can go about creating those comics yourselves. So it's both. She's going to be giving you a bit of background on alternate comics and alternate voices in comics and how you can create them yourselves. That class starts May 3rd and goes to June 7th. And registration for both these classes is now open. You can register by giving us a call at the office at 206-934-3705, or you can register online by visiting www.learnatnorth.org.
And if they call that number, will they get your dulcet tones?
Only
on the other
if they're
end?
Lucky, Ben Lawrence. Only if they're lucky.
All righty.
Cool. Oh, and if that was too much information or you need something you can hold in your hands, I have actually dropped off spring quarter catalogs at the counter at Comics Dungeon. So drop by and pick them up. And you know what? Maybe there are other classes that you might that might tickle your fancy.
Comics Dungeon, of course. Here.
My work here is done.
Here, 319.
No. We don't offer ceramics anymore.
That's an inside joke. Well,
seriously,
y'all.
Don't get me started on the ceramics classes.
All right. Pick up those catalogs at North Seattle College near you, or here at Comics Dungeon at 319
yes.
Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford.
Indeed.
Anyway, let's talk about Vertigo. Vulture.com recently had an article about how Vertigo changed comics forever, and I have this document in my Google. In my Google Docs for the podcast called the 10-cent bin. And it's just where I put stuff where I'm like, I might want to talk about that someday. Mm-hmm. And this article in Vulture piqued my interest
I just got that.
And one of those days. And so let's talk about Vertigo, because they were a thing.
Yep.
And then they weren't a thing,
right?
But they're going to become a thing again.
If they're lucky.
Maybe.
Yeah. If DC is lucky.
All right. So the crux of the article is that my takeaway from it was that Vertigo was basically a trendsetter. And like all trendsetters, the trend caught up to them and they were no longer unique.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. just kind of faltered. This article basically says that the ED of Vertigo, Berger, I don't remember her first name.
Karen
Berger. They say that when she left in 2013, that's kind of when things started to stagnate. But let's go back a bit, friends. Let's talk about what exactly Vertigo is.
Well, Vertigo started out, a gentleman by the name of Alan Moore got his hands on Swamp Thing. And it was
dastardly man.
Oh, he's just, and he's evil. He is truly evil.
Len Wein hired him. Yeah.
And he started writing stories that just really didn't fit into the DC universe anymore. And they came up with this, I can't remember who it was, but I think it was actually Moore himself, came up with the tag Sophisticated Suspense. And because they were looking at horror stories that actually were just a little bit too highbrow for folks who are regularly, you know, reading comics. And I think that was the first Vertigo title, correct?
Hmm?
I'm looking at you, Chris.
Sorry, I was reading my notes.
Oh, he was tuning me out.
Sorry. No. Sorry.
I want to say that was the gateway
Swamp
title
Thing.
Was Swamp
yeah,
Thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I can't tell you what came next and how it sort of filled in around it.
Well, so let's
you
see.
Got
that's,
notes there.
Well, here's the
I
thing.
I was just riffing, dude.
Here's my problem too. I ran out of white paper, and this is printed on red, and I'm like,
is it hard for your eyeballs?
Focusing here.
Okay.
So my note was, Berger started recruiting UK writers, specifically Gaiman, Milligan, and Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
And so first wave would have been Animal Man, Doom Patrol, Shade the Changing Man,
right.
and Black Orchid, which is Gaiman's first work at DC.
And these are a lot of these writers were getting their gigs, were working for 2000 AD,
mm-hmm.
which is a long running, was it a weekly?
I thought it was weekly.
Yeah,
but...
sci-fi, pretty sophisticated sci-fi comic anthology book in the UK.
The first book that featured the Vertigo imprint was Death, the High Cost of Living.
Wow.
Yeah.
So
it took a while.
It was a spinoff
for that.
Yeah.
The spinoff from.
So Sandman wasn't even. Vertigo didn't exist when Sandman started mm-hmm. being published.
And then
right?
the second new title under that was Enigma by Peter Milligan. So.
That was a limited series.
Yeah.
It was like a six. It's Alfredo.
I could tell. No, no.
No, no. It's. No. It'll come to me.
Yeah, okay.
It's Pete Milligan and...
Yeah, and then you saw Kid Eternity.
Duncan Fedrego.
There you go. Kid Eternity, and then you also would eventually get Sandman, Mr. Theater, and the one-shot by D. Matthias and Paul Johnson, Mercy.
Right.
So you started getting waves of Vertigo, but that early, early chunk is always Neil Gaiman, Peter Milligan, Grant Morrison, and because he was already there, Alan Moore.
And they started doing these really cool things where they took these Golden Age and Silver Age DC occult characters and gave them one shots and tried them out and say, hey, can we turn them inside out in this adult format and make them work the way Gaiman did with Sandman and the way Alan Moore did with Swamp Thing. And they would give like Dr. Occult a one shot and give him really weird perverse stories, and then Brother Power the Geek, and they I mean they did some kind of risky, cool things, but there were all these weird one-shots, and I was very fond of them.
And you would have some other more, I'm not going to say mainstream, but like Jonah Hex would basically be mm-hmm. shunted over to Vertigo for a while.
Right.
Because it just allowed them to do more with a bunch of these third-tier, fourth-tier characters.
And they were given some of these titles to people who were going to do some risky things. Like, case in point was, it was Joe R. Lansdale and Tim Truman did Jonah Hex, and it was mm-hmm. like this H.P. Lovecraft Western, and it was really wrong, and I really liked it.
And you would get guys like Ted McKeever, who under mm-hmm. no circumstances would ever get a mainstream job just because of his art style.
Right.
And it opened the gates for the industry to kind of, you know, take a look at these creators
yep.
and, you know, do something with them. So then there was an interesting note, and I think I lost some of it in my note-taking here. But there was another company, it's not Touchmark, there was some sort of Disney project that they were going to take and create some new properties for, and it fell through, and they just moved them over to Vertigo. And that included Sebastian Oh and Skin Graft and The Last One. And so it kind of became a dumping on point for some other failed projects.
Right.
But in a good way. That makes it sound kind of bad. Because they would also eventually try some more sci-fi related works under the Helix imprint. And that failed horribly.
That was miserable.
But they were able to absorb things like Transmetropolitan.
Yes.
And create a long running popular series that way.
Right.
And this is where you get the next wave of people like Warren Ellis.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Somebody take it from me.
Does Fables, was that one that
yes.
got kind of like rebranded as Vertigo?
Nope,
or was
nope.
it under the
no,
Vertigo?
That started as Vertigo.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it really started out as, you know, we were last week or 2 weeks ago, we were talking about the new DC Black Label. What are they calling it? Is it Black Label?
Black Label.
It's
Black
Label. DC Johnny Walker yeah. Black Label.
Yeah. That's how you
but,
remember.
You know, once upon a time, that was actually a good idea, and DC was taking risks on these kind of books, like, you know, turning Doom Patrol into a whacked out psychedelic
so cool.
adults format, adult style book, Animal Man.
Yep.
You know, these as Chris said, these third and fourth tier characters that nobody really cared about, and give them to these hungry, innovative, out of the box creators, mm-hmm. and they went to town on them. And then it just started to run out of gas, probably because after Berger left, I can't remember, was it Shelley Bond?
Shelley Bond took yeah. over.
So yep. she just kept trying to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
And I think that's where she went wrong.
Well, before we go down there, was there anything more to add?
No, I want to go down there.
Well, we will.
yeah. Let's see. So what time period are you talking? You're talking about like 2013, if you're talking about Berger taking over, I think.
Berger left Berger in leaving. 2013.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So we're right about where I was going to okay. lead towards.
Did I help you or hinder you?
No, you helped me. You helped that's me kind of work about. Through a bunch of this. So we'll hit right back to you. But quick notes. So like the next... chunk of stuff is like where you get Fables
and Preacher is early 90s.
Well, right? So here's some dates to help us with all this. So let's see here. You got The Invisible starting in 1994 mm-hmm. and going to 2000, and you got Preacher at 1995 and going to 2000. Mm-hmm. You got Transmetropolitan at 97 going to 2002, and 100 Bullets starting at 1999, and Why the Last Man starting at 2002. And Fable starting at 2002. So the early 2000s and like the dead end of 1990s is where you get that kind of, I think I want to call it the third wave. Maybe it's fourth wave. Mm-hmm. And that's where things were still pretty strong for a bit. Because between Transmit, Preacher, 100 Bullets, you have a lot of really original concepts. And they were really getting behind them.
Hardcore sociopolitical commentary happening.
Yes.
We're not rebooting superhero properties anymore. We're coming to the table with wholly original properties that are, in the case of like Preacher, are scary in their originality and their vicious satire.
Yeah. And then so when you mentioned Shelley Bond stuff, that's mm-hmm. when it reinventing the wheel is a very good way of putting it, because that's where Steam just started to disappear. And by 2016, DC restructured Vertigo, eliminating Bond's position and replacing her. Oversight was placed on Jamie S. Rich, and it's like Oversight just sounds like he had some babysitter taking care of stuff.
And I can't remember what titles we're talking about from that time period. When was Why the Last Man?
Why the Last Man ends by 2008.
Okay.
Yeah, and DMZ ends around 2012. Mm-hmm. Fables goes to 2015, Fables becomes the flagship title.
It does.
At that point.
And it gets tired,
unfortunately. And it gets tired, and it wasn't meant to be that.
I love that book, but it got so tired.
Yeah. And then so that next wave coming up is, there's good stuff amongst it, but we're hitting that period where Image has become what Vertigo was, and it's become the innovator, and you got stuff like Saga and Chew and all these other new projects coming out.
Or you have people who were, you know, quote unquote Vertigo writers like Brian K. Vaughan moving over to Image to, I imagine because they felt their work was going to be better supported through Image.
I remember reading in a quick interview from Sean Murphy, And this is the guy who's doing Batman White Knight right now. And he did a series called Punk Rock Jesus. And he, looking back on it, he's like, I would have made so much more money if I went to the Image. But he kept it at Vertigo. So you get projects like that popping up. You got stuff like the Hinterlands and a bunch of others that we've all forgotten now because
Northerners. Was the Viking series?
Northlanders.
Yeah,
they're starting to reprint those because those were going out of print.
Those were actually pretty
good.
But
Hinterlands was good. Punk Rock Jesus is good.
Yep.
Yeah.
But we've kind of started to forget about all of these because they got lost. Because there's the overall industry problem of the oversaturation we're at.
Right.
Image is having that problem. So Image is having the old Vertigo problem, for me anyway, as a retailer. And so that lands us right now where they need to figure out if they can bring it back as a viable imprint.
Yeah, and they took all those imprints like... Shade the Changing Man, and they made Doom Patrol and stuff like that, and they created a new imprint called Young Animal. So all of those things that were known for at Vertigo are now at this new imprint called Young Animal. So they can't even revive those for Vertigo because it's its own. Like now, there's all these these imprints.
And we haven't talked about Young Animals for a while. I mean, I know you were incredibly disenchanted by Shade the Changing Girl.
Yeah.
And I am reading Doom Patrol, but I think it is incredibly lackluster, and I'm bored with it. Mm. I know you were, Nicole,
I enjoyed the first volume, but I haven't gone back to it since.
No, I read it every month, and I don't remember what's happening because I'm so bored with it.
It's so very referential to the old material.
It's super annoying.
That I feel like it's really hard to penetrate as a new reader.
Well, and they just had the crossover event with mainstream DC, so they thought the direction they needed to go was to try and introduce it to more mainstream readers and to take it even further away from Vertigo. Was my interpretation of that. And so this new Vertigo that we're talking about, that's the Sandman verse, it feels like they decided to put all the eggs into that basket of just everything that has anything to be vaguely related to Sandman. Mm-hmm. So I will bet you money we'll see Black Orchid at some point connected to all that. And
there's no such thing as a Black Orchid.
I know. But
what? What are you whispering over there?
It's a tagline from the comic book.
But it makes a logical kind of sense. I could see them thinking that's the way to go. I just still don't know if it matters.
Sure.
Does DC even need to relaunch the Vertigo line?
And that's the question. Maybe it's time to just let it go.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand wanting to maintain that history because it was successful and groundbreaking for a long time. Mm-hmm. But like we've said with so many things before, maybe they should just let it die.
Yeah.
Either that or do something that would be risky for now, you know, like pulling in these brand new creators that maybe are really popular on the internet or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that would even work, but internet popular.
My brain's doing the thing. It's like if Image became Vertigo, maybe Vertigo needs to become Fantagraphics, and Fantagraphics can become Drawn in Quarterly.
Yes.
It's musical chairs as far as what you're doing.
Interesting.
Pretty much.
I think what you're saying about webcomics makes a bunch more sense.
Yeah.
They need to basically turn Vertigo, I think, into a scout publisher.
Yeah.
A way to bring in talents from online and get them more exposed.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no limiter to genre within Vertigo. And that's, I think, better than just going full in supernatural, which is what Sandman verse is.
Right.
Literary supernatural realism, magical realism. I don't know. Yeah, it was so much love to experiment in a different way.
And the boundlessness of the internet where anything really does go. I mean, like really queer and all kinds of things, all kinds of interesting concepts that people are doing with no need for that kind of editing or suppression is probably the best bet because that's the biggest risk, right?
Yeah, that would be more in tune to the original message of Vertigo.
Yeah,
because originally it was, you know, to try and do more adult and more sophisticated work, but also there was in some of my research here, there was a part where Berger said that the viewpoints of all the UK guys was just so uniquely different from what was on the industry at that point in time that that's probably the strength of it. It was exposing the American readers to a different perspective and a different approach to all these characters and styles of stories. That's what the webcomic community can do
for
mainstream comics right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, but instead they're just like, what's successful? Sandman, do that. Milk it.
Right.
So,
which we're seeing that all across the board in a lot of ways in a lot of different publishing houses.
Yep.
Yeah. How are we seeing that? Vertigo's like, Sandman was popular, let's milk that. What other instances are there?
Well, I think the bleeding over of, like, Prometheus is now showing up in DC Universe and stuff like that. Like, that just like, well, this was popular, shove them in Justice League, you know? And it's like, no.
Taking certain properties that didn't really belong in certain places and putting them over. So DC mainstream is absorbing Alan Moore's properties from 10 years ago.
That's right.
Stuff like that. Marvel's just regurgitating itself again and again at the rebirthing. And even over in Image, there's little mini movements that they're just like, this month, sci-fi. There's like four new titles where there's an astronaut in the cover, and it's just like, okay, you're just kind of stuck on this one thing. Mm-hmm. You need to figure out a different approach, you know? This next month, all fantasy.
Yeah, watercolor fantasy. Yes. Look, it's so blurry. It's beautiful. It's cool, but it's lost.
There's a marketing that makes sense of like, let's put like things out together. But it doesn't help the oversaturation problem.
Yeah.
And being innovative, I think, helps.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Vertigo, let's move on to Book Report and talk about part two of our combined book report of Preacher.
I'm so excited.
Preacher, of course, is one of the more successful Vertigo titles, and we all read... If you haven't seen our first Preacher book report, go back and look that up.
Well, again, the challenge is, like, I have trades that are, you know... The original trades from back in the that, but I mean, you guys are not reading the same editions I am, and apparently I read more than you did.
That's fine. It's fine.
But
you
I mean,
read what you want.
I don't
just join us.
Want to talk about what you're going to talk about. I want to talk about what you didn't read. So anyway, I'm being difficult. Go ahead.
All right.
Absolutely.
So
I'll make one quick confession, real quick. So I've lost track of everything this week because I've been busy, and I thought we were podcasting a day before than we actually did, and I had not caught up to my reading on Preacher. So I sat down Tuesday night at like about midnight, and I was like, let's just skim this. I know what happens. So I was going to BS all you guys. And then I started skimming it, and I was like, oh, that happened. So I started reading it, and then I was up till 3 o'clock, and I'm a good two volumes ahead of you guys right now.
Excellent. So the volume that we're focusing on today is the All in the Family storyline?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Because the collection I have was called Until the End of the World, and it featured All in the Family and then Hunters, which introduced Hare Star and the Grail.
So just short of the Hare Star introduction. So
Tulipin and Jesse are abducted by Jesse's evil grandmother.
Yes.
And her henchmen.
And her henchmen.
Jody and TC.
Yeah. Yep.
Yes. A more perverse and violent pair of characters I had not experienced in comic books until this point in time.
It's interesting because I wouldn't exactly call Preacher sort of over the top, if that makes sense. Everything, even though it's magical, even though there are vampires, everything seems kind of to be on a level playing field.
Mm-hmm. A pretty level, yeah.
But TC just seemed buffoonish in his sexual deviancy. Yes. I mean, I'm like,
that's a good
really,
one.
Really, are you really going that far and above? Like, Jody is this monster, and but like, you turn around and TC's effing a chicken, you know?
And he's got this long monologue about, you know, getting his jollies off a fish he caught. And actually, that's just par for the course for Garth Ennis.
Yeah.
He has such a tremendous. Well, I doubled back and started looking at his actual stuff because I couldn't remember. I'll make a confession. I sometimes have trouble distinguishing Garth Ennis from Warren Ellis. And I actually have to sit down and say, Ennis wrote these books and Ellis wrote these books. So for my own edification, just to clarify, Mr. Ennis was born in 1970. He's a Northern Irish-born, naturalized American citizen. So, in reading these stories of Angelville, where these, you know, we're meeting Jesse's grandmother, who is this ancient wheelchair-bound religious fanatic who has tortured everyone within her reach, I'm kind of looking at Mr. Ennis's stories as really harsh satire and examination of American, middle American Christianity and religiosity in particular, and this unique take that he has as a foreign-born Irishman. And I know he's a self-proclaimed atheist, which
Catholicism is pretty hardcore in the Irish lands.
Right.
So
right.
It wouldn't just necessarily be commentary on American life and Christianity. Because I feel like he just does.
These are Heartland American psychopaths, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's not. He's not giving us character. My point being, he's not giving us characters that are European in this arc. This is a really. I'm not being critical. I love this.
Yeah.
But what I'm trying to figure out, trying to look at, is his analysis, discussion, and satire that he's sharing with us, and what he wants us to see.
It was a little flavoring of Southern Baptist, where God is life.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, just wanted to share that with you.
What I like about reading this arc as opposed to the first arc, the first arc was almost like a warm up, like getting reacquainted with an old friend.
Yeah,
this one made me realize, like, oh my God, I love this series so much. I want to read the rest of it immediately now. And I think it was just because of you get so much more backstory of what everyone had been dealing with, and you get these interesting characters. You get Jesse's family life, his mother, his father.
How he was shaped.
Such a beautiful relationship I think he had with his father. Cute moments of them regurgitating John Wayne quotes, and it was so cute. But then you also get these horrible monsters and this cult-like mentality of you can never leave. You can never leave us and have your own life. You belong to us. You're like our property or our blood. And... it's, you know, to the end of the world, his undying love for Tulip.
Right.
And this undying, like, not love, but this possessiveness. You know, it's like
of course.
There's these parallels going
so
on.
So we get the backstory on, more of the backstory of his relationship with Tulip, and that there was actually more to it than we learned about from the first story arc, which I really appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
And you get his family and his mom. Now, I also am reminded of the fact, in reading these back-to-back and closely together, of how many balls Mr. Ennis drops. And it's like, oh, do we come back to that? So question, and spoiler alert, do we come back to the resurrection of Tulip at some point down the road? Because I don't remember.
What do you mean come back?
Like, is it explained later on more than it is in this?
Yeah. You don't
I mean,
need
it
to
is
be.
Explained. Yeah.
God, literally God, just said, you're back to life.
God tried to have a pawn in the, what's the word? He tried to like get some leverage.
He was manipulating from the very beginning.
Yes.
Because he set it up so that they would all go to Angelville.
Uh-huh.
And even though he gave them immunity over the power of God's voice, he was going to take it back immediately and basically dangled the carrot of Tulip in front of him, being like, leave me alone. Here's your girlfriend.
Yeah.
You know?
Because he knows they're going to come back. They're so horrible, they're going to kill Tulip, so they shoot her in the head and immediately shoots back.
I missed something in there, because when Tulip is resurrected and we've got because I couldn't tell if it was supposed to be God that she's talking to, or some pretender, or and I'm kind of blending stuff, because he loses his ability to, at some point in the story that we read, he loses his ability, his power over the voice. And he also loses it in the TV series as well. But it's a confidence thing.
He never loses it.
He just can't use it on the family, on Jody, TC, and the grandmother.
God temporarily shut it off as affecting them, and they mention that. The grandma says, you don't have any power over us because God's watching over me, because he literally is. And he manipulated them, and he purposely took it, gave it back, the power over them, back to Jesse. So it's all handled right in that chunk there.
So we're saying that God has a say in how Genesis's power works through Jesse?
Only insofar as that he can make certain people immune to it.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. I missed all that. I'm sorry.
Uh-huh.
I didn't catch that at all.
So I would like to talk about Jody a little bit, because Jody's the reason I ended up reading like five chapters past you guys, because I feel that he's such an effective villain in such a small amount of time with very little dialogue overall. But it's just the combination of Ennis's use of the character and the way he's drawn and the way everybody reacts to him and such. It's just the strength of these creators together. But, I don't know. There's just something so horrible about Jody and how quickly he is to be able to take people down and just do horrible things.
It is one of those things where when you're watching a hero story, you vote for the hero, but after a while, if the hero can never meet his match, it gets boring. Mm-hmm. So Jody provides that sort of the match, the guy who can bring down the hero.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And the final fight with them, I thought, was pretty great. Just the whole part where Jesse refuses to use the word
yes,
on him.
Yes, I liked that.
And he takes him all down. And you get the really weird moment where even though he lost, Jody's like, I'm proud of you, boy. It's like so terrible because he's got these messed up way of looking at the world.
He even says something like, because the grandma was so obsessed with Jesse, like, and he was always refusing of it. That's why, like, Jody just held something kind of against him on top of everything.
Yeah.
So you even get this layer of, like, his own personal motivations about, like, really being rough with Jesse.
Yep.
Which I like it. The little bit that he does say, you get these elements, you know, mm-hmm. and you get a strong sense of who this villain is.
And the same thing with grandma, because there's the sequence where the grandma decides to kill her own daughter.
Yes.
And there's just a really quick narration from Jesse there saying, like, that moment when you can see in her eyes when she had what's in her to be able to decide that her own child was not worth keeping around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that's what made me just kind of blast through the next, like, two books worth. That kind of scripting and that strength of characters.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead.
One of the things that was really evocative was the Jesse having to spend days, months inside the coffin at the bottom of the lake.
Yes, multiple times.
Multiple times.
Yeah.
Now, did you catch that Jody said he makes some comment about, but you didn't know who was tied to the top of your coffin?
Yeah.
I'm assuming it's his mom.
No.
No, it's Billy Bob.
It's Billy Bob.
It's his friend.
His friend.
The one-eyed kid.
But we never see that. Did we see that?
It's just mentioned immediately after, so you know it's what happened.
See, yeah, you guys make these connections that I don't for some reason.
Well, okay, to give you a little something, I found that stuff switched up a little bit faster in this next arc for me on my reread.
Yeah.
So I did, like, double check that I didn't, like, miss something because it just, like, changes gears. So I don't
know. That's what
if
I made the reference to dropping the ball.
That might have been it.
I don't see the ball. I see a ball being dropped when it's not.
Because I think what I remember from that scene was Jesse set it up and just said, like, where's Billy Bob? And they just said, well,
okay,
all
right. He says, oh,
my
well,
mind
I
must
guess
have
you
wandered
didn't,
and I missed that
you
detail.
You didn't notice the thing on the coffin
so
or whatever.
Something like that.
I started getting the impression that, and help me out here, that Grandma has been grooming Jesse for something, and I felt like there was an implication that she had some foresight that he was going to be absorbing the power of Genesis at some point, or
all the men are preachers, so there's this, like, you need to be a preacher.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, she knew about Genesis, but I didn't get the idea that she included. She knew it kind of after the fact.
Okay.
She didn't know it was coming to him. So they were still grooming him no matter what over time.
Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm kind of stuck on his power not work. Because I was flipping through the pages where he tries to, right early on, where he tries to stop Jody and it doesn't work. And Jody just basically says, okay, well, now we got that. I think he just says, now we got that out of the way. And they move on.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm having trouble with is that they're saying that grandma's connection to the divine is authentic.
Yes.
Okay.
Because God came to her.
Yeah.
But only recently.
Well, plenty of evangelicals can say such things. But but in the context of this story, God really did come to her. And that's where I got stuck.
There's a specific page where they show that
there's
happening.
There's a panel where you see a hand and
sure.
Yeah.
But am I to be led to believe that that's authentic? Or...
But I'm with you. Okay. I didn't fully buy that until Tulip was resurrected,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then that's when I thought, okay, there's something here.
Yeah.
And it's not just Grandma talking out of her oxygen tank.
All right.
See,
cool.
And I'm projecting full end of series reading backwards on it,
mm-hmm.
Because I don't think there's ever any point in the story where they establish another divine character that can ever pose as God. Mm-hmm. So there was never a secondary option for me to go throughout the reading. Okay. So when God showed up, he left enough ultimatums and be like, hey, you need to just like stop this whole thing. Uh-huh. Don't push it, he said once. You know?
Yes, right. Don't push it. Yeah.
I just read that as like, oh, it's God. You know?
Yeah. So. Mm. The coloring's a little different too. I know like on the reread, seeing the hand show up when grandma was there, I was like, oh, is this some other entity? Because I can't remember like what I read. Most of the time in the series. So it's like, then I realized like, oh no, that's the same. That's okay. That's just God, so, like playing all of them all as pawns.
Maybe because I was trying to work this out, is how authentic is grandma's divine power, or is she just evil?
She's just evil.
and God chose her.
Okay.
That see, God comes
that's a whole new
up.
Level of
God's,
holy crap.
God's
going
essentially
on
evil throughout this series.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So that's what I needed confirmation on.
Not okay. Great.
Yeah.
She made a bet early on, which ended up coming to her in her favor, right? Mm. Mm-hmm. Because God eventually did come to her.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which makes these stories all the more timeless and particularly poignant right now. Yeah.
This was the second reading for everybody here except me. What did you get this time around that you didn't get the last time?
Well, apparently for me, it was a boatload more confusion.
Like, did we learn anything new?
This is my 13th reading, at least.
Yeah.
Are you keeping track?
Wow. I basically read once a year or so. Maybe I've missed one or two.
That's amazing. Because I haven't touched these
anymore.
I haven't touched these in like 20 years. Yeah. So.
I don't know if I took much more this time.
Yeah. It's just like revisiting an old friend.
I think what I took more of is that
the old friend
is Ennis's ability to has a direct line to my brain somehow throughout all this, mm-hmm. because the way he characterizes is enough to make me forget how tired I am, along with my insomnia, and to just go ahead and sit down and read straight through two to three volumes when I didn't have to.
Yep.
That's a power of his that I forgot that he had, and it's this particular time frame.
Mm-hmm.
I was really, what was really brought home to me was his examination of what and that's why I was talking earlier about American Christianity and his take on it as a quote unquote foreigner, but his damning examination of the brutality of faith.
Yes,
it's really dark. Mm-hmm. It's really wretched, and I'm not. And of course, our sympathies are going to be with Jesse, Tulip, and Cassidy for the most part, but. Because he continues to me. I mean, the next arc is, following this, is getting to know about the Grail and Hare Star and that, and then we get to
Featherstone
and New Gamora, or the Gamora. Is it New Gamora? What?
Masada?
No, Masada is where.
Yeah.
Masada is where the Grail is located.
Oh,
but
New
the,
Gamora. Yeah, the
hedonist, the parties, the heroine, all that stuff. Yeah.
I will say one thing I did take is how much I miss Steve Dillon.
Yeah.
You know, he's a really good artist. His range and expressivity.
Yeah, his facial expressions.
How good, he was at that. But what I'm what my point being is that these stories are really threatening to people of faith. I mean, these are really, really ripping on Christian faith.
Were these books ever banned, like in Texas?
Oh, I'm sure.
They had to have been.
Yeah.
I'm sure. Yeah. If anyone ever found out they existed.
I think they made it under the radar, actually, quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that the TV series is dodging a lot of the harsher things.
I figured it would be.
I'll never be able to do it.
Yeah, how would you be able to?
Did they get to New Gamora?
Not yet, but they're doing things out of order, and they're building up
characters. I bet you they skip up to
one. No, they're going to skip that. But, you know, we are seeding the Angelville and Grandma and Jody and TC stuff because... one of the first things you see in the first in the early episodes is the shadowy figures shooting Dad and Jesse's dad and Jesse witnessing this and that being having, you know, and we're going to come back to that. I think maybe, I can't remember what the cliffhanger was for the second season, but I think we're coming to that. Cool. Anyway, yeah, just really razor condemnation. I like it a lot.
I love that.
And did you, Nicole, come away with anything new on this most recent rereading?
My heart was filled with happiness and joy. Yeah, I just, you know, I commented in our last read-along that Cassidy and Jesse get a little bro-y. And what I was referencing in particular to was Jesse saying to Cassidy, like, ha, I'm going to get her in bed and blah, blah, blah time or whatever. And I just, it caught me off guard because I remember their Tulip and Jesse's love so hardcore. Mm-hmm. And that line obviously just didn't really matter. And it was an interesting to read that and then to go into the Until the End of the World, which is him saying, I will love you until the end of the world.
Yeah.
And how deep their love runs and how poignant that is to me now in the place that I'm at in my own personal relationship and how I'm like, hell yes. So I don't know. I just, it really ignited the fire, like to the point where I didn't know if I was going to be able to do the read along.
Right.
And I was really sad. I was like, no, I don't care if I have to be late to things. Like, I have to, everything worked out fine time-wise, but like, I needed to make it a point because I was reading it and I was like, I need to finish this. I'm so in love with the series. And usually I'm like, eh, whatever. Didn't get to it. It's so sad. Maybe next time. But this one was just like, no. So, yeah, all right. I look forward to more.
Cool. Well, that's the part two of our Preacher read-along. Tune in sometime in the distant future or not so distant future when we revisit part three. That is Book Report, and that is our show. And coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, as well as the Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Find us on Facebook or however you get your podcast at perfectboundpodcast.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes, TuneIn, or whatever. Send us an email at perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. And now, friends, it's time for quiz time. And this week, the questions come to us from me, and I'm doing a little something different this week. These are comic book mashups. I'm going to give you a description of a fictional comic book or character, the product of a mashup of two different titles, and you have to tell me what the new title is. You'll get where I'm going with this after the first
one.
You seem
so tickled by this.
Yeah. Pretty happy about this.
I'm pretty happy. I apologize for some of these, too.
You got one really good pun in there that just made you so happy.
Yes.
Someone is killing prostitutes in the Whitechapel district of Victorian London. The detective on the case is a half-demon with red skin and a large right hand of doom ready to enact vengeance if he ever finds Jack the Ripper. What is the name of this new comic?
From Hellboy.
From Hellboy.
Nice! Nice!
All right.
That could be a thing.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. Number two. A group of survivors try to make a new life in a post-apocalyptic zombie landscape. Only one thing stands in their way. A wisecracking, fourth-wall-breaking zombie that no matter how much or where you shoot him, he keeps regenerating and stumbling towards you, making obscene gestures and lame dick jokes along the way.
Walking Deadpool.
The Walking Deadpool.
How has that not happened already?
Yeah.
All right.
That. That's great.
So those are my two favorites. Apologize for
those. The lame ones.
Okay, number three. A cyborg, in a desperate attempt to maintain his humanity, comes across an old house and discovers a well which leads to a demon dimension. See, not all of these are so obvious.
There's just a lot of cyborgs.
Yeah.
I know. I couldn't find any other distinguishing features other than this cyborg has been... A number of people have claimed this cyborg's body.
Oh, Deathlock and Key.
Yes!
Oh, that is really good. That's really good.
Nice. Good job, Ben. Yeah,
yeah. All right, number four. These two mannequin twins were brought to life by Mr. Doll in the slum area of the pan-dimensional city of Sinosure, who eventually becomes sword-for-hire ex-paramilitary and eventually owner of Munden's, a bar in Sinosure.
This is a lot.
This is a hard one.
Mundans.
What was the first part of that?
Two mannequin twins who were brought to life by Mr. Doll.
Two twins.
What's Mundans from?
Grimjack.
Oh.
Two mannequin twins.
It's also the title. I'm giving it away. It's the title of a bunch of fairy tales.
Wait, don't tell me.
It's like a Says You or something like that.
Yeah.
You did get Grimjack. Grimjack is the final word. Yeah. Three.
Grim Fairy Tale Jack.
Two. It is Brothers Grim Jack.
Oh, I was almost there. Oh.
All right.
Good job.
And finally, this pulp hero of the 30s and 40s is described as a physician, scientist, adventurer, detective, inventor, explorer, researcher who has green skin, large fins, super strength, and an advanced healing factor. And he eventually becomes a full officer of the Chicago Police Department.
Doc Savage Dragon.
Doc Savage Dragon is correct. All right, that is. I came up with a bunch of these, so we'll revisit this again.
Good.
All right, so that is quiz time. That is our show. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.